universal gravitational constant, big G, as it's known in the trade, is written with a capital G. The values of big G have been fluctuating wildly. Even in the last 10 years, it's varied by more than 1.3%. Most people assume these things are accurate to many places of decimals, but not so. Big G varies embarrassingly. And how they actually fix the value of G is they get different labs around the world measure it. They take an average of their measurements, discarding ones that seem to be too far off on the grounds they must be errors. Then the different labs submit them to the International Committee on Metrology. They then discard any values from labs where they think the lab must have got it wrong because it doesn't agree with the others, average the remaining ones, and come up with what's called the best value of G. When I left Dr. Petley's office, he said, oh, by the way, you might like to see this. He says, just come from the press, and he leant down beneath his desk. There was a cardboard box full of pamphlets. He pulled one out and gave it to me. He said, the latest values of the physical constants. So some scientists, well, some philosophers, Alfred North Whitehead, for example, who was a mathematician as well as a philosopher, had a theory of relativity that differed from Einstein's. And his differed in that it predicted that the measurements of big G would vary from time to time as measured on Earth. And so there is a reason for thinking they might vary. They might also vary if there really is dark matter and if it's in clouds of uneven density, if the Earth passes through them in its orbit around the Sun, or if the Earth in different parts of its orbit is affected differently by dark matter out there in the galaxy, it could affect these measurements. So the question is, do these measurements vary similarly all around the world? In 1994, in my book, Seven Experiments That Could Change the World, I tried to encourage metrologists to look at the raw data and see, are they all the values of G all up, say, in June and down in July or down in December? Do they vary together? Is there a cyclical variation in these around the world? They refused to do it because they said, G is constant. This is a meaningless question. But the data are there. It wouldn't cost very much to do this. It's terribly frustrating that it hasn't been done. I think if it was done, we might find meaningful variations in G, which could actually be analyzed and give rise to new science. The day may come when we open scientific journals like Nature every week, and there might be a page like the stock market reports on the constants. This week, G held constant, C was up a little bit, the fine structure constant was down, there's been a fall in the charge on the electron. It might be that there's a quality of time which might, because of different balances in the strength of the different constants. It would mean different things could happen at different times. All these things are possible, but we'll never find out if we have the dogmatic assumption they're constant and all the variations are ironed out. So there's the assumption that the constants of nature are fixed. It's nothing but an assumption. Some physicists have proposed they might actually vary over time. But for the most part, this question is not entertained within science. But there's no reason it shouldn't be, and it's not as if science as we know it will collapse. It would get more interesting, and we might find out something really new. Now, I'll take another of these assumptions now, that memories are stored inside the brain. Now, this is something that not just scientists take for granted, but most people take for granted. If you just ask the average person you meet on the street, where are memories? They'd say, in your head. It's just a standard assumption of our whole culture. Now, where's the evidence that memories are in our head? Well, many people say you don't need any evidence. It's obvious. They've got to be there. Where else could they be? Some people say, well, you might have tissue memory, muscle memory, etc., but it's still physically located in the body. It's got to be there. How else could it possibly work? This is an assumption. There are actually alternatives, and the idea that memories are stored in the brain has been questioned by philosophers for centuries. Plotinus, in his theory of the soul, thought that memories were an aspect of the soul, not of the body, and were not stored in the brain. Henri Bergson, the great French philosopher, in his book Matter and Memory, provided a persuasive argument that memories are not stored in the brain. There's another kind of causation, a causation across time, which can carry memories across time without them being stored in brains. Bertrand Russell, the British philosopher, agreed with Bergson, and he proposed that there was a new kind of causation that he called mnemic causation, a kind of causation that leaps across time, connecting similar things across time. Ludwig Wittgenstein came to the conclusion that memory was not stored in the brain. He was one of the most influential philosophers in the English-speaking world in the 20th century. My own view is that memory depends on a kind of resonance with the past. When you meet somebody you haven't seen for a while and you recognize them, you resonate with yourself in the past, the last time you saw them. And there's a resonance across time that gives you that feeling of recognition. You know you've seen them before. It's not, in the meantime, stored inside your brain. There isn't a kind of copy of their face somewhere embedded in your nervous system. Well, what about the evidence? For 100 years, people have been trying to find the putative memory traces inside brains. In the 1950s, there was a determined attempt to find these by Carl Lashley here in the United States, who trained rats and monkeys to learn a wide variety of tricks. Once they'd learned the trick, he cut out bits of their brain to find out where the memories were stored. And to his surprise, he found that he could cut out large amounts of the brain. It didn't matter which amount, right, left, front, back, upper, lower. He could cut out large chunks of the brain without destroying the memory. He came to the conclusion that memory seemed to be both everywhere and nowhere in particular. It couldn't be localized. His student, Carl Pribram, took this idea further with his idea of the holographic storage of memories, that they're stored like a hologram over large regions of the brain. Since then, there have been further determined efforts to find memories, either in modified nerve endings, in phosphorylated proteins, or in other molecular mechanisms. Over and over again, they've drawn a blank. We know that when memories are laid down, there's activity in certain regions of the brain, particularly the hippocampus. And when the memories are retrieved, there's activity in the brain that can be detected by brain scans. But in between, they just seem to disappear. Now, does this make people think, are they really there? No. They just say, we haven't found out where they are yet. We need a few billion more dollars and we'll have another determined attempt to find them. But you see, the reason that they can't find them may be very simple. They may not be there. It may be rather like coming to your house and trying to find what programs you watched last night on television. Can I find out by analyzing the transistors and wires in your TV set? No, I can't, because it doesn't leave a trace in the TV set. That's not how TV works. It tunes in. It doesn't store. It's not a video recorder. It's a receiver. I think our brains are much more like receivers than recording devices. And of course, if you damage a receiver, you can damage the ability to retrieve memory. If I came and damaged the sound circuit of your TV set, I could make your TV set aphasic. It wouldn't speak. But that wouldn't prove that all the sounds that come out of the TV set are originating inside that bit of the TV set or that they're stored there. Similarly, brain damage through injury, stroke, or degenerative diseases like Alzheimer's doesn't prove, if the memory's lost, that the memory's stored in the damaged or decaying tissue. It merely shows that this is affecting the ability to retrieve the memory. So it turns out that memory storage in the brain is an extremely open question. Morphic resonance depends on similarity. We're all similar to lots of people in the past, especially members of our own family. And it would explain what Jung called the collective unconscious, a collective memory on which we all draw. And I'm not saying I'm definitely right about this, and so is Bergson and Bertrand Russell and Ludwig Wittgenstein and Plotinus. I'm saying that there's a long tradition of looking at memory in a different way, and the evidence favours this alternative way, and yet 100% of research on memory, paid for by NIH and other funding bodies to the tune of billions of dollars a year, is based on the unquestioned assumption it's got to be in the brain. There's no other alternative that you can discuss within that framework of thought. Any discussion that's not in the brain is taboo. Then we come to the assumption that the mind is in the brain. The mind is the brain. Mental activity is brain activity. This says that everything you experience is somehow inside your head. But is it? We've all been brought up with that assumption. It's something that ordinary people, even in ordinary conversation, say. If they say it's in my mind, they often say it's in my head. It's an assumption that runs through our entire civilization and which we're now busy spreading to the rest of the world through modern scientific education. So, is it true? Well, I think if you think about vision just as a starting point, it's fairly easy to see that when you think about it, it just collapses as an assumption. We all know the scientific explanation. Light's reflected from me, travels through the electromagnetic field, enters your eyes, inverted images on your retinas, changes in the cone cells, impulses up the optic nerve, and activity in different regions of the brain, the optical cortex and elsewhere. So far, so good. But is that an explanation of vision? No, it's just a description of the changes that happen in your nervous system and in your eyes. How does that explain the conscious experience of seeing? Well, the answer to that is it doesn't. That none of this explains consciousness at all, which is why the mere existence of consciousness is called the hard problem by philosophers of mind. So then, what might be going on? Well, where are these images located? The usual assumption is that your nervous system mysteriously generates a virtual reality display in full color and 3D inside your head, and that's what you're experiencing. That means that when you see me standing here now, there's a little Rupert somewhere inside your head. That, believe it or not, is the official view, taken to its logical extreme. The view I'm putting forward, by contrast, is so simple that it's hard to grasp. I'm suggesting your image of me is in your mind, but not inside your brain. Vision involves an inward movement of light and an outward projection of images. That everything you see in the world around you is projected out. Your mind extends far beyond your brain. Most children under the age of 10 believe that the eye projects out images. Jean Piaget, the developmental psychologist, found that under the age of 10, most European children believe that vision involves an outward projection as well as an inward movement of light. However, Piaget said, rather pleased with himself, that by the age of 10 or 11, the average child learns the correct view, which is that thoughts and images are invisible things located inside the head. Now, most of us have taken that on trust, but no one's ever seen a thought or an image inside a head. All they've seen is electrical changes in brain activity. So, is this just a philosophical question, or can it be tested? Now, as some of you already know, this is something I've devoted some time to, because if your mind reaches out to touch what you're looking at, you should be able to affect what you're looking at just by looking at it. Most people have had the feeling of being stared at, and have felt when people are looking at them from behind. If you look at them from behind, through a window, they can't hear you, they can't smell you, they can't see you, they don't know you're there by any other means. Can they feel your gaze? I've done lots of experiments. These experiments have given consistent, repeatable results. People can tell, above chance, when they're being stared at. This experiment's also been running in the Amsterdam Science Museum, the NAMO Center, for 15 years now. Tens of thousands of people have taken part. It's one of the biggest experiments ever done. The results are overwhelmingly positive and statistically significant. This is one line of argument that I think is persuasive in showing that the mind isn't confined to the inside of the head. The same theory is taken to mean that all our sensations of our body are in our brain. If I feel a pain in my toe, the pain isn't in my toe, it's in my brain. And it's referred to my toe in a rather unexplained way. What I'm saying is that just as my image of you is where it seems to be, namely outside me and where you're sitting, if I feel a pain in my toe, that pain is in the toe. It's not inside my brain. The brain may play a part, it does play a part in the sensation of pain and registering it, but the sensation is not in the brain. The brain just doesn't do that. It's not what it's doing. It's working in some quite different way. Just as people have tried to cram all hereditary information into the genes, I think a lot of it's conveyed by morphic resonance. I've only dealt with three of the dogmas this evening, and only with part of them at that. But this just gives you a flavour. And when you look at these dogmas in a critical scientific way, it turns out that as hypotheses, they're not supported by the evidence. Better hypotheses are possible. This doesn't mean that the whole of science collapses and Western civilization falls into ruins. It means science gets more exciting, more interesting, and we can ask new questions. Well, how might science move forward? There are two ways I think that are really important. I think the first is something we can all play a part in. The world of professional science is full of people who've had psychic experiences, who have spiritual practices, who go to alternative practitioners, and so forth. They're not all scientific fundamentalists and true believing materialists. Richard Dawkins has done us all a good favour by crystallising those views and making them fully explicit. This is certainly a point of view. Many scientists are actually not paid-up materialists who feel a deep need to believe in this worldview. They go along with it in public because not to do so would damage their career. It's a bit like communism in Russia under Brezhnev. When communism collapsed, how many were true believers in communism? A few, there were certainly some, but it wasn't a majority. And I think that's true in science today. Another factor that's important here is that the demographics of science are changing dramatically. The majority of young scientists today are not from white, European and American backgrounds, and they have no reason to believe in this inherited baggage of the materialist worldview which has come to us through the European history of science. They do so at work, or pretend to do so, because they know it would damage their career not to. I think one of the things that would change science most is if scientists felt the ability to come out to their colleagues and talk about what they really experience and what they're really interested in. This occurred to me most forcefully when I gave a seminar in Cambridge on some of my work on dogs that know when their owners are coming home. There were six scientists in this small seminar. They were all interested in the results. They talked about it politely. They were very non-committal in the official question period. They asked about the statistics, the methodology, and so on. But afterwards, one by one, they came up and they said to me, you know, I've always been interested in this kind of thing. It's one reason I went into this in the first place. And another would come up, look around during the tea break. If no one was listening, he said, you know, I've got a dog that does this right now. You know, when I go home from the lab, it's waiting for me at the door. When all six had told me they thought this was happening, and when all six had said the same thing to me, but I can't talk about it to my colleagues because they're all so straight, I said to them, why don't you guys come out? You'd have so much more fun. And I think this is the way forward within the sciences. I think there's so many people there who have spiritual interests, psychic experiences and so forth, that daren't or can't talk about them to their colleagues. If they do so, they'll find that many of their colleagues share these interests, and the conversation in the laboratory tea room would become so much more interesting than it is at present. And these kinds of bigger questions I'm talking about would become part of the scientific debate rather than being marginalised and kept in taboo areas where if scientists talk about them at all, they do it with their colleagues after a few glasses of wine with trusted friends in the evenings. Since I've been out for decades, scientists feel quite free to talk to me. I've been having a series of clandestine meetings with eminent scientists. And for good reasons, they explain to me why they can't let their colleagues know what their true views are. And for one or two, the price is very heavy. They'll lose their grants, they won't get their papers published in high citation peer review journals, they won't get tenure or promotion. But if enough people do it, it would be like gays and the gay liberation movement. It would be empowering, mutually empowering. And it would just make science so much more fun and much more attractive to young people. Right now, it really puts off a lot of bright young people because they see it as just a load of dry facts you've got to learn. If they were aware that lots of questions are truly open, I think it would be a very different situation. Well, I think that's enough to give you a flavour of this book, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I'm a science major, and I was completely disillusioned with the way it was taught and the way it is founded. And you taught us that science, when it moved away during the time of the Enlightenment, away from the church, has become even more dogmatic, perhaps, or equally dogmatic as the church. My question to you is, can we use certain positive aspects of science, such as the empirical methods of research, can we try to impose rationality on the paranormal?
Well, first of all, I think we can investigate a lot of things rationally and scientifically that science doesn't at present investigate because of these taboos. I'm all in favour of reason and science as long as they're reasonable and scientific. And I think that if we take a scientific and reasonable look at phenomena like telepathy, it turns out that they're not paranormal in the sense of beyond the normal, they're normal. Animals have them, they seem to be a normal means of communication among members of animal groups. Many dogs and cats and parrots and horses show telepathic responses to their human owners. In the human realm, telepathy is common. More than 80% of people have had telepathic experiences in relation to phone calls. So, first of all, I would say that whole realms of stuff that are at present classified as paranormal are normal and perfectly investigatable using standard scientific methods and statistics. That's a lot of what I do myself. I'm pro-science, not anti-science, and my book is pro-science, not anti-science. So I think there's a large range of phenomena that science has arbitrarily excluded on the grounds of dogmatic narrowness that an expanded science could include in a larger paradigm, a larger model of reality. I think, however, there are certain things which perhaps can't ever be brought within a scientific purview of predictability, and one of them is the creative impulse itself. Creativity seems to be inherent in the whole cosmos at every level, chemical, molecular, biological, mental, social. The whole universe in evolution is an interplay, in my view, between habit and creativity. Habits lead to repetitions and the regularities of nature, which are very important, and without them we wouldn't be here. But the creativity, when new things happen, it's literally unpredictable. If you could predict the next creative breakthrough in any subject, you would have made that breakthrough. You can't predict creativity, and I think that's because there's an element of freedom in the whole evolutionary process, a creative freedom which works through evolution, which can't be pinned down by science.
How do you think about the public education of science, especially in a country like America, where there's a large sector of the population that's actively denying many what would seem to be scientific facts?
Well, there is no country like America. This sort of anti-science movement, creationist movement, hardly exists in Europe or in most other parts of the world. It's a peculiarly American phenomenon. The reason the book's title is different in America is because the American publishers thought that the science delusion would be mistaken in America as being a creationist tract and climate change denial and so on, which it's not. So Science Set Free actually better expresses what the book's about. I think most people are quite capable of understanding there can be uncertainties. There's uncertainties in everything about the weather, the economic prospects, you know, one's health. Everything's uncertain. Science has created an illusion of certainty, which I think has done a great deal of harm, and it's one of the reasons that we have the science delusion. So my own approach is to show that science can, in fact, investigate things that people haven't looked at before. For example, my research on dogs that know when their owners are coming home. Most people, on the right or the left, are really interested in, does my dog really know when I'm coming home? This isn't a political issue. It's a scientific one. And you know, some people say, well, it's just routine, or they smell you. And then you can do experiments to find out, is it just routine? Can they just be smelly? And when I talked about these things in popular newspapers and on popular television channels, I find most people are truly curious. It doesn't arouse dogmatic responses, and people feel this is the kind of thing science should be doing. I think it is the kind of thing science should be doing.
On New Dimensions today, we've been listening to Dr. Rupert Sheldrake introducing his book, Science Set Free. If you'd like more information about Dr. Sheldrake, his work, and his books, you can find it at www.sheldrake.org. That's sheldrake.org. Or you can get there via the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Dan Drazen. You've been listening to New Dimensions. This is program number 3476. You've been listening to A New Dimensions Archive Edition, recorded in 2012. New Dimensions Radio has been making a difference on our planet since 1973, thanks to the generosity of our listeners. You too can help make a difference with a tax-deductible donation or membership. Please visit our website, newdimensions.org, and just click the donate button. You can also subscribe to our free weekly podcasts and find over 1,000 hours of audio dialogues in our searchable archive. New Dimensions is produced by New Dimensions Radio in Santa Rosa, California, USA. Our executive producer is Justine Willis-Toms. Our post-production editor is Lou Judson. For over four decades, New Dimensions has been producing weekly conversations at the leading edge. We sincerely thank all of you who have supported us by being members of Friends of New Dimensions, as well as members of our affiliate stations. My name is Dan Drayson. On behalf of everyone at New Dimensions, whose endeavors make this program possible, I'm wishing you well. New Dimensions Radio is an independent producer supported by listener contributions. To find out more about the program you've just heard, to subscribe to our free weekly newsletter and our New Dimensions and New Dimensions Cafe podcasts, and to access thousands of other programs in the New Dimensions archive, please visit our website, newdimensions.org. That's newdimensions.org. Or call us at 707-468-5215. That's 707-468-5215. Please join us next time as we explore New Dimensions.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, your alternative to mainstream media. Broadcasting from Simon Fraser University at Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia.
Birdnose. You've probably heard the old saying, a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. Well, it's a very old saying, and it's gone through some changes over the years. The phrase first pops up in a 7th century Aramaic proverb. Better is a sparrow held tight in the hand than 1,000 birds flying about in the air. An English book from the 15th century had this version. It is more certain a bird in your fist than to have three in the sky above. 100 years later, there was another old English saying, better one bird in hand than 10 in the wood. In each era, the pragmatic wisdom is clear. Hold on to the sure thing rather than taking a gamble on something better. The old saying eventually made it to Pennsylvania, where there's a town named Bird in Hand. Legend has it that when two road surveyors in the early 1700s were trying to decide whether to stay the night where they were working or head back to Lancaster, one cited the bird in hand proverb. They decided to stay, and the place was named Bird in Hand. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. This episode is brought to you by Wild Delight Bird Food, which aims to support wild bird populations with clean, nutritious ingredients in every blend. Available at Chewy.com.
CJSF is 90.1 FM, broadcasting from the heights of Burnaby Mountain.
You can deny all the things I've seen, all the things I've discovered, but not for much longer. Because too many others know what's happening out there.
Hosted by award-winning independent journalist Amy Goodman. Tune in to Your Daily Progressive News, aired Monday through Friday at 11 a.m. on CJSF.